Hi, I'm Meredith.
And I'm Katie.
And you're listening to I'm Not Scared, You're Scared,
a horror movie podcast.
If you're a fan of the show, please like and follow us on iTunes and Spotify and review us. It'll help spread the word.
Also, you can follow us on Instagram at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared, or email us at I'm Not Scared, You're Scared at gmail.com. Boom. Did I do that?
I don't know. Okay, thanks for joining us. Katie may have been weird.
But may have been?
Well, it may not have recorded, so who can say?
Well, somebody will be able to say at some point, but we can't tell you right now.
So we are talking about two movies today.
It's a Shyamalan twofer.
The Village, released in 2004, and Knock at
the Cabin, released in 2023.
Yes, his most recent film. Streaming now.
Absolutely.
On a Roku / Fire Stick near.
on your closest available
device. Yes.
But before that, riveting experience for all of you. Meredith needs to tell us what's new with her.
Okay.
You have to. It's formulaic.
I feel so boring right now. I'm just like school. I had a runny nose. My son's doing baseball. The season just ended. I feel very like nothing's going on. But there's going to be Mother's Day tomorrow.
Yes.
And Victor, an amazing engineer, and now my husband. Which is weird saying all the time.
Like is it also, have you yet called him the kid's stepfather?
Sort of, not really to anybody.
I feel like that would be a weirder transition for me to like from calling him like my boyfriend to my fiance to my husband of, starting to call him their stepfather.
Stepdad. Well, Deke once, he's been kind of referring to him as his stepdad before we even got married. I think someone was trying to take his hat. And someone, you know, he's like, don't mess up my hat. It's my stepdad's hat. And I was like, aww, you little cutie patootie. Anyway, so for him, he's like, yeah, I was already calling him that. So whatever.
No biggie.
No biggie. But I do say, you are my favorite husband.
By far and away.
By far, my favorite husband.
You are dominating that competition.
He's like, I should hope so. But he did ask me, he said, you know, what do you want for Mother's Day? And very quickly, I said, I want to be left alone. I mean, I'm joking. No, it's not. Not really. I was like,
you know, don't leave me entirely alone. Still bring me foods and drinks.
I want food and drinks. I want to hang out with my family, but I also want to have a little alone time because what we do for work is very overstimulating.
Yes. The interaction, the level of interaction with other living life forms is a lot.
And you just get like worn out from making hundreds of decisions a day.
Yeah.
And saying the same thing over and over again.
And then having them ask you.
Yes.
Anyway.
And it's written. You say it four times.
Yeah. It's written on the paper in front of you, the board at the front of the room, and I've said it three times.
Yep. And imagine that, and except it's 6 and 7 year old, so they're even...
You can't get
a little kookier.
And you also can't get as mad at them. Like, I've got 11 and 12 year olds. It's like, dude.
You're like, you're just being lazy.
Like, shape up and listen. Like, what the fuck are you doing? But it's like a little one. I gotta get it.
They're like missing their front teeth.
Yeah, your brain is mush right now.
They're like, excuse me?
If you have to potty, everything goes out the window.
Oh, yeah, I know. There's a lot of like... pee-pee dances, like, I have to go. And I'm like, go ahead.
Don't let me stop you.
I know.
So, yeah, so, I have the same thing for a different reason, only it's the girls at my grade level. Yeah. Like, I have all these, like, well, no, if we just came back from recess, you don't get to go to the bathroom, blah, blah, blah. But if a girl raises her hand and goes, can I go to the bathroom? I go, yes, go. Go yes. Now.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be the one that, like, keeps you from doing it. Everything they're going through.
If you're dealing with a thing.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be.
That is possibly new to you, maybe even for the first time.
Yeah. I'm not going to be the jerk.
Nope.
In your childhood problems.
Yeah.
When you recount them later as an adult.
Yeah. In your memoir.
Yes. So I asked for, I just want some breakfast in bed. That's, like, one of my favorite things to do. I know it's really gross. Eating in bed.
Oh, I eat in bed all the
time. I like to eat in bed. I like to have my snacks.
I like to find the crumbs later and be like, oh, look, a oh, cashew. Look, a
second snack. Yum. No, that's not, stale. Not quite like that. But I like to have my coffee, have some toast, just relax, turn on a show, then get up when I feel like it, not get up and go, like I usually do during the weekdays when I'm quickly getting ready for work. So that's what I asked, and I'm sure I'll be waited on hand and foot a little bit, which is, you know, I'll take it. And I think that's all I asked for. I'm kind of boring, but... Yeah.
Well, next time we record, you can report to what extent they fulfilled those expectations.
Yeah. Maybe next... Well, if they're like, anything else, I'll be like, please wash my car, because it's embarrassing. It looks very janky and embarrassing. I think from our last road trip, which was for the wedding, still bugs from the I-5.
You're like, these are Southern California bugs.
These bugs got to get out of here. This is no good. So anyway, what is new with you?
Well, tomorrow's Mother's Day for me also, but... Well, I don't know what I'm doing yet. It's supposed to be a surprise, so maybe next time I'll report on that as well. But what I did realize I should share with our listeners is I went to see a newly released horror movie. I've realized that now that Tom is willing to go see scary movies in the theater with me, I'm seeing them... like way more regularly, because like when I want to go with you and Victor, like the scheduling and the coordinating is challenging.
Yeah.
But I like live with this guy. And so it's like, well, let's go to the movies. And so like the past three movies we've seen in the theater have been horror movies. We saw The Exorcist Believer. We saw The First Omen. And then we went and saw Tarot, which I hadn't heard anything about. It just popped up on Fandango because we were just looking to go to the movies. And I like to not know anything about movies going into it because I feel like you enjoy it more and you enjoy it the way that the filmmaker intended, rather than how the people that cut the trailer intended. I wish I had done a little research on this one because, boy, was it a big pile of crap.
Oh, no. I have to look this up.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was called Tarot. So, you know, immediately you've got some sort of like idea of what the framework might be. But basically it was a cross between Ouija and Final Destination in a bad way.
Ooh, yuck.
Yeah.
This has 2.5 stars.
Yeah, no, it was so bad. It was the script was bad. The acting was bad. The characters were not developed. The plot was a joke. It was just like, and it's funny because, you know, Tom's not a real horror movie connoisseur. And so, you know, he was, you know, he had his mouth shut or whatever, but like 15 minutes into it, I leaned over to him and I was like, this is terrible. And he's like, I'm really glad you said that. Cause like his fear was that I was sitting there thinking this was an amazing movie. And he's like, oh God.
I'm just not getting it, I guess.
Yeah, no, it was kind of sad because also like the one thing that it brought to the table to some extent was the visual effects for the creepy characters that were based, you know, this isn't too much of a spoiler. I hope nobody's actually going to see it after I've said this. But the characters based on all of the different tarot cards, you know, so they're like, they become personified as part of the story. And the effects and makeup and characterization of those tarot characters visually was actually pretty cool and in some ways scary, but the way that it was utilized and in the context of such a dumpster fire of a movie, it could not benefit from it. Like in a better movie, those you would have been talking about how creepy and scary those characters were, but it was just like the whole rest of the movie was so shitty that you couldn't even appreciate the one part that they were kind of doing right.
Well, I guess I'll turn it on while I'm folding laundry.
Yeah, so that you can confirm. Yeah. And that's because for me to say, like, I would not watch it again. And for me to say that is bad because I recently rewatched Crossroads with Britney Spears, which I had not seen since it came out in like 2002. I will rewatch almost anything.
But not this one.
This one and Beverly Hills Ninja with Chris Farley.
Won't watch that again?
No.
Well,
no, I think that's it.
That's okay.
That's a short list.
Yeah, it's very short. because there's a lot of really bad movies.
Maybe from Justin to Kelly. When they
Leprechaun?
I would rewatch Leprechaun.
Jesus.
Yeah. Because when I'm talking about rewatching, I'm saying like you're suggesting just putting it on in the background.
Yeah.
Not sitting down, chin on my hands, eyes glued to the screen for the whole thing.
And be like, I'm ready.
I wouldn't even put Tarot on in the background.
Ugh, not worth it.
No.
Ugh. I do want to see, before we move on, I mentioned it before we started recording, Late Night with the Devil.
Mm-hmm. Which I haven't heard anything about.
Yes. So I listened to this other podcast. I know it's terrible to listen to other podcasts.
I'm shocked and appalled and a little brokenhearted.
I know. Yeah, anyway, so last podcast on the left is one of my favorites. I know they're not your favorite, but no. I love them. Anyway, they had the main actor from that movie on it. He was also in Last Voyage of the Demeter, and you would recognize him from a lot of other movies.
Yeah, he's got a pretty memorable face.
Yeah, for like Dune, he was in The Dark Knight, a lot of other stuff. But it's about I'll just do a short little version. He's a late night host. It's like in the 70s. He's really he's hanging by a thread, trying to keep his show on the air because their, you know, ratings not great. And so he's kind of making unethical decisions when it comes to his decision making process to keep himself on the air and still relevant. Mm-hmm. So he brings on a guest that's supposedly some infested or, you know, possessed with a demon or the devil or something. And I'm excited to see it. Yeah. So
is it it's the autobiography of Arsenio Hall?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm hearing.
Yep. Woo. I barely remember even that show at all. I think I watched it once when I was like up throwing up when I was a little kid.
Okay.
Or had a fever and I was like, oh, what's that? What's going on?
What's going on? And then you found a horror movie to put on instead.
And I was like, yuck, I can watch Nightmare on Elm Street instead. Okay, so let's see. I'm doing the recap of The Village. I keep wanting to say The Visit because they're both V-I
even, V-I. Not just V.
V-I films. So I'll start reading mine first. And then we can chat about it. And then yours, recap of Knock at the Cabin.
You, then me, then you, then you, me. Then
me,
what,
you, me.
What is that from?
Night at the Roxbury.
Yeah.
And SNL.
Yes.
Our OG SNL.
Anyway, but yes, we're going to start with The Village. It did come out first. It's Meredith's turn. So
it's my turn. So the film opens with a community observing a grieving man in a cemetery. The man, who the actor is Brendan Gleeson, he's playing a man named August. And we see that he's, it's about the 1800s, that's what it says on the gravestone. And the person he is grieving, he's kind of like, his arms are outstretched. He's, you know, putting his body on a little bit, his arm kind of holding the coffin, is a child. So you assume he's the father of this little boy who died. The entire community is eating dinner later at a long table, and they all freeze for a moment as they hear weird noises in the surrounding woods. Everyone looks solemn with the exception of Noah Percy, who's played by Adrian Brody. He's laughing and like chuckling a little bit, but he's also developmentally delayed in some way. It's not really explained what he's dealing with, but.
And it's like, I mean, should we go ahead and mention now, like, do you find that problematic? That portrayal, or did you think that it was, like,
of Adrian Brody?
Yeah, that character.
You know, it's funny because I had that same conversation with Victor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me finish the recap, and I can tell you about what we said that. Because I was like, this is kind of interesting that how far we've come as far as what actors represent who.
Yes.
And or whom, I don't know, whatever, in movies, and what is acceptable and what we should just be like, oh, that's fine. Or no, actually, we need to be more thoughtful.
Yeah.
In our casting because
if you
choices.
Haven't like seen this, like it's basically like every grammar school kid pretending to be a, you know, mentally disabled person.
Yeah. So But this character is played by Adrian Brody.
Who's an incredibly gifted actor. So
he's the pianist. He's amazing. So community members then tend to their chores. We see them hide the forbidden color, which is red because it attracts the beasts / monsters in the woods. There's a perimeter and a night watch and they protect the village nightly from whatever is lurking in the woods. Later, the community elders are discussing the happenings in the village, and Lucius, played by Joaquin Phoenix, has asked to go and address the elders. He asks to go visit the towns for medicines because he's tired of seeing children, you know, waste away and die from whatever illness is happening. Mm-hmm. The community members feel that the outside towns are a wicked place, and they say you cannot go. Basically, he's denied. So then later, Lucius goes to visit his friend who's keeping watch at the tower, and that just seems to be their lives, living in this village, very secluded. Mm-hmm. Throughout the movie, skinned animals are found in the town, and it is thought that the creatures from the woods left these dead animals, which is another thing that if they can't go in the woods, but it's also thought that whatever these things are coming into their village and leaving kind of omens to stay away, which is kind of scary. So then later, Kitty Walker, played by Judy Greer, who I love, proclaims her love for Lucius, and of course, he denies her because he loves someone else, who Kitty's blind sister, Ivy, played by Bryce Dallas Howard.
Not the only film that they've played sisters in, which I'm like, I can see why people keep casting you two as sisters.
I know, yeah. Ivy is very capable, and it seems like she is a teacher of some kind as well. She just seems to be in charge of the school kids. Throughout the film, she's very close with Noah, and she asks him to promise not to hit people again. So the two of them strike a deal. This is like kind of early on in the movie. As Ivy and Noah are hanging out and enjoying each other's company, it becomes clear that Noah has gone beyond the border to gather berries that he places in Ivy's hands. Lucius is there and asks again to speak to the elders because Noah was safe from, quote, unquote, those they do not speak of, because he was able to play in the woods and remained unharmed. At this point, Lucius's mother, Alice, tells him about his father and what happened to him. She says that he was murdered in the towns, and the towns are a wicked and terrible place. Mm-hmm. And he was violently killed. It was very, very terrible. She does not want him to go to the towns, and Lucius says that his intentions are pure. He just wants to help the people in his village. He just cares a lot about them. Mm-hmm. He also points out the large black box in the corner, which holds secrets that she keeps. And he said, well, why don't we just open this box? And why are we having these secrets? Can't we just like bring it out in the open? She refuses, and the conversation seems to be finished. But Lucius also then reveals that he believes Edward Walker, who's another town elder, has feelings for his mother.
We should mention his mother is Sigourney Weaver.
This is her.
A crazy cast.
This cast is stacked.
Yeah.
Like, amazing. So the next morning, Lucius enters the woods and something sees him. And then later that night, the creatures enter the village, and it is a fantastic scene. The night watch, they ring the alarm bells. It's pretty scary.
Yeah, it's very tense.
The night watch is like looking down, and they see this like hooded, it has like spikes. Mm-hmm. It's like a deep red cloak.
Yeah, thing. But it's got like almost like porcupine spikes like coming through like the cloak out its back. Yeah, like a hedgehog.
And it's kind of like lumber. It's like
hunched over, and you can't really see the face.
Yeah, and it's like claws and stuff. It's super creepy. Everyone goes to hide in fear, and they're kind of under the floor of their homes.
Yeah, they have little panic rooms.
Yeah, kind of.
1800s panic rooms.
But Ivy waits for Lucius outside on the porch. She's like, he's going to come for me.
Yeah.
And it's clear as he comes running toward her, as the creatures are coming within view of the viewer and them, that the two of them love one another. And he grabs her hand to make sure she's protected and safe. Later, Kitty has found another love. Someone else.
Moved right on.
Yeah. And they got married. And the guy who played her husband, or the other guy, was in Cabin in the Woods. He's a stoner guy.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, I know him from something, but I can't remember. So then during the wedding celebration, another village elder, played by Cherry Jones, who I love her so much,
amazing,
reveals that Ivy reminds her so much of her sister, who did not live past her 23rd birthday. The celebration is unfortunately interrupted by screams from young children. They said they saw something horrible. The entire village goes to see what was left, And they're pretty alarmed. They see hanging and skinned carcasses of animals at different doors of the houses. Mm-hmm. The villagers are very worried and scared. And Edward and Alice have a secret conversation as they discuss what it was that left the carcasses. Ivy and Lucius finally declare their love for one another, and the entire village finds out. Noah is pretty unhappy, and he goes to talk to Lucius, or so Lucius innocently thinks. Mm-hmm. And Noah stabs him with a knife in the gut, and then Lucius is barely hanging on to life at this point.
That was like a pretty, like, talking about what a really gifted actor does with a scene compared to just like anybody. Yeah. Because like Adrian Brody, that moment, like when he, you know, he stabs him and then Lucius falls and then he puts the knife down on the table, but he's like, because of his, you know, mental condition, like he puts the knife down on the table and then, but he's like upset and panicking and he turns to the door and then he turns back and he picks the knife back up and then he like crouches down next to Lucius on the floor and then you don't know if he's going to try and help him or whatever. And then he like stabs him again. And it's like that whole scene is just like, it's heartbreaking and like kind of and suspenseful, and it's just like
quiet.
And it's really, really so beautifully performed, because Adrian Brody, I think, was like really, you know, capturing that character.
Yes, it's an insane scene. And then Lucius looks so surprised that this could happen to him, because mm-hmm. he'd never really known a violence in you know, in his community.
Yeah. And Noah seems surprised that he did it.
Yeah.
Because like it was just was like he has no impulse control.
Right.
Yeah.
So at this point, Ivy asks to go to the town to get medicines, and her father agrees to let her go, and only her go with two escorts who must stop traveling with her at a certain point. And she is asked, she needs to continue on her own. Mm-hmm. Noah is kept in a room. I think it's in a schoolhouse as the village figures out what to do with him.
Mm-hmm. It's the quiet room.
Yeah. Kind of like, this is where you need to sit and think about what you did.
Yeah.
Kind of place. The elders do not agree with Edward's decision, but feel that what kept them out of the towns happened to Lucius, and whatever happens to their way of life happens. Like, August agrees that they had a good run, and if it ends, it ends. Mm-hmm. Everything they built and worked for. And you're kind of like, well, maybe is it the village? Is it the, you know, what does this mean?
What are they
exactly
referring to?
Yeah. They are very upset, but Edward is basically like, you know, a crime happened to Lucius. This is what we were trying to protect innocence.
And we didn't succeed. And,
yeah.
It appeared anyway.
It's here anyway. And we owe this to him, basically. Mm-hmm. Not to be like, oh, well, you know, we've committed to this. And they're like very upset. So then Ivy goes with her two escorts, who really can't hack it at all. But before she goes, she's given the truth. And there's a revelation given by Edward about the village. Her grandfather, Edward's father, was very, very wealthy, and he was murdered in his sleep. And he reveals a shed where she's been told really not to go into her whole life.
Yeah.
And he's, before he lets her in, he says, please don't scream.
Yeah.
So inside, the creatures that are in the woods are hanging there, and they're simply costumes. Mm-hmm. And the lore was created by the elders to keep all of the villagers from leaving the woods.
Yeah, they go, it's a farce.
It's a farce. And they're like, and the noises are in the woods are created by the elders. Mm-hmm. I think in a deleted scene, it was like wind chimes and things like that that make the woo sounds. So as Ivy goes through the woods, she has to manage to remain safe and travel on her own, because her escorts kind of puss out, basically.
Yeah. They're well, because one of them is Michael Pitt, too.
I know.
And Jesse Eisenberg is in this, too, is like a small role.
So many people. And she has initially these magic rocks.
Yeah.
They're not really. She knows that
she
not
knows
real,
they're not
right?
magic, but these boys aren't supposed to know.
They're like terrified.
Yeah.
And she's been told you cannot give the secret up. So she's like, we have these magic rocks. And they're like, well, why haven't we heard about these magic rocks before?
Yeah, if we had these magic rocks this whole time, why have we been hiding in the village?
I know. So they are like, they travel with her like a little bit, and they're like, yeah, we're gonna go. And she's like, well, I'm gonna keep going, because I have to protect, you know. Yeah, save.
I hate because Michael Pitt's character, when he goes like, you're braver out here than most boys, or than the boys, or whatever. Like, that makes it okay that he's ditching this blind girl alone in the woods because she's so brave for a girl.
Yeah, he's like, we'll see ya. So, I know, it's terrible. So, she has to go and manage it on her own. And she has her walking stick as she's trying to traverse these woods that are, you know, pretty scary. She almost falls into a giant hole where a tree has fallen and left a big, big pit, yeah, essentially. It seems that the only hurdle that she has to get has to overcome is getting to the town safely. But something is pursuing her, dressed as one of the monsters. Hold on, I have to go. I'm dying.
Don't die. We're in the middle of an episode.
I'm like, I have to cough.
Well, and it's funny because, like, I feel like the way that they presented the monsters, like, based on the revelation that Ivy's dad gave her, that there were these costumes, he does say, like, he tells her, because it's been mentioned a couple times that he is the schoolhouse teacher and that he was a professor before. And he says that there were legends of creatures in these woods from, you know, the olden days. I used to teach about it. And yeah, so I think that, like, building that in, and then he presents her with the costumes, but I feel like it still leaves a little bit of an opening or a possibility that the creatures are still real. Like, maybe that's the twist.
Like a planting of the seed.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Exactly. And, like, you know, because he says that they created these costumes based on a legend of things that actually did exist. And so now that we've had this revelation that they've been faking all of this behavior, and then she goes out into the woods and they're like, now that we know they've been faking it, we're wondering, why is this one of the elders who's, like, mad that her dad let her go and they're gonna attack her? Or is this a real actual creature out there that their costumes were just based on? And that's the big revelation.
Yeah.
So she's being stalked by this creature, but I feel like maybe the first time I saw it or whatever, you're still not 100%. Is this a human in one of the costumes, or is there really a creature?
Yeah. Is this just happenstance that they were pretending when there was something actually there the whole time?
Yeah, because they modeled their creatures after a legend. So maybe the legend was true and the creatures were actually out there. So it was like both simultaneously.
You don't know.
Yeah.
But we do know at this point, she feels like she's being stalked, and she is. And mm-hmm. we see, as if you are very far off, we see a figure in the red cloak.
Yeah, with the spikes
and stuff. And whatever it is chasing her. And she manages to evade it, and the creature is mistakenly falls back into the pit where she mm-hmm. had crawled out of earlier before.
Yeah. She, like, tricks him into happening. Like, she figures out that she's back at the pit by this particular branch, and then, like, lures him and then steps out of the way at the last minute.
Yes. And it's whatever the creature is, it falls to the bottom of the pit, and it's revealed that it was Noah, and he had gotten one of the costumes and escaped through one of the windows of this house, mm-hmm. this schoolhouse. And it ends up killing him in the process.
Yeah, the fall.
Yeah. So she eventually makes it to the border, or the road. She makes it to a fence and jumps over, where she's found by a park ranger who's driving a modern day Land Rover.
Yeah.
It is not the late 1800s. It's modern present day.
Yeah. And his vehicle has painted on the side of it
Walker Preserve or whatever. Mm. So, which is Ivy's family.
Right. Her rich very, grandfather.
Very, very rich family. So there's a whoop, whoop. And she's like, what was that noise? What was that noise? And then at first he's like, I feel like you're trying to trick me. And she's like, I don't understand.
I love that actor. He's so cute.
Yeah. It was such a lovely scene. And I like it so much. So she hands him a list of medications, mm-hmm. but they refer to as medicines that Lucius needs. He's like, is someone hurt out there? And she's like, I need this. And she looks, she just has the solemn, like, determined look on her face.
And she keeps calling him sir.
Sir.
Yeah.
You know, and he's like, you know, there's shacks, you know, there's guard stations every, I can't remember how many miles, and they stock a lot of these medications in case of injuries or animal bites. Mm-hmm. I can go get them. Mm-hmm. So he goes to the shack, and his supervisor is M. Night Shyamalan.
Yep. Like, he likes to, off camera.
He likes to do a little
Stephen King routine.
Well, Stephen King, or like what else? I'm
Another director who does it?
Yeah, but like it's a huge director and I'm spacing and I'm feeling stupid. Huh. Psycho director, hello. Oh. Hitchcock. Okay.
I almost said Adolf Hitler.
No.
Alfred Hitchcock. Alfred Hitchcock. Hitler loved doing cameos in his films.
I know, what a little scamp. Yeah, so it felt very like Hitchcock or, yeah, you know, he's, you know, the minister, Stephen King's the minister in Pet Sematary. Mm-hmm. So he goes to get these medicines, and as he's doing that, his like a coworker slash boss is like, you know, this is an easy gig. We're paid so much money to make sure no one goes in.
Yeah, and it's basically like, don't ask questions. That's all we have to do.
And he's like, and you know, a few years ago, I there was a whole thing about, you know, how that they were paid off, the government was paid off, and this whole place is a no-fly zone.
Yeah.
So it's like, it kind of slashes out any kind of like, oh, well, but what about the planes when they fly over them? Yeah, yeah. You know. So we get that little bit of information too. So then later, Edward and his wife, they open up his own chest full of secrets once we have the revelation of this is modern day times.
Yeah.
This is not in the late 1800s, as we are led to believe. And it's revealed that all the town elders met at grief counseling support group. And they lost someone really important in their lives, and all of whom were killed savagely.
Yeah, all result of crime.
Yeah. And Edward, a history professor with a very, very wealthy family, came up with an idea of creating a society away from violence. Mm-hmm. And he kind of was like in the position where he could bankroll the whole thing. Mm-hmm. So later, Ivy returns from the town with medicine for Lucius. She doesn't even know it's modern times because she can't see. And that's maybe why he sent her in the first place, yeah, not himself. Edward also comforts Noah's parents after they learn of his death, saying that the death will further perpetuate the myth of the monsters in the woods.
Yeah, he was like, we'll get his body, we'll give him a proper burial, and that'll strengthen our story.
Yes, it'll live on.
Yeah.
And that is the village.
Yeah.
So, are we going to go into, do you think it was scary?
Sure. Yeah. I do remember finding this scary the first time that I saw it. I thought that the creatures were scary. The scene that you referred to that was like really suspenseful when they come into the village the first time and Ivy, like Kitty's down in their little under the floor bunker trying to get Ivy to come in. And Ivy's like, no, Lucius isn't back. And she's like, he'll be fine. He's somewhere else. Get in here. And she's like, no, he'll come back to it. And so she's like standing there and she can't see. And you see like the out of focus creature approaching her, and it's nighttime. And then there's like a slow-mo little bit. But like, I remember that being kind of frightening. And then the scene of Ivy at the end with the creature that turned out to be Noah. I remember that being pretty scary. But I think that was because when I saw this for the first time, I remember the buy-in of the creatures, of them actually being creatures. Mm-hmm. I wasn't suspicious or onto the whole gig of the whole thing that it was going to be some sort of trick or whatever. And then even when after it's revealed, you know, that the elders were doing that and seeing the creature in the woods, I still found the creature frightening because I still felt like it was uncertain what was really happening.
It's the New Jersey Devil.
So I thought that those parts were scary, and like the like we said that the cast was super super impressive, and the whole setting was very charming, the whole village, like the, you know, alluding to that time period and everything. And then, you know, we paired this with the Knock at the Cabin movie because of that whole, you know, it's another secluded setting.
Yeah.
One of the previous themes that we've done. And so there's something inherently like that part of the story is already a little bit done for you when you've got creepy woods.
Yeah.
You know, like some of your work is done here because you've got creepy woods and there's things in the woods.
And add her having to deal with getting through the woods safely as a woman who's blind.
Yeah.
And, you know, and figuring out where it's safe to even walk.
Yeah.
Because the floor, the ground might come out from under you.
Yeah, suddenly. Like it did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that there were a handful of scenes, primarily dealing with the creatures, that I thought was scary the first time that I saw it. I would say overall the movie's not super scary, but it definitely has that M. Night Shyamalan feel to it, of mm-hmm. the suspense and the unwinding of a story with, you know, it's not like, ooh, the whole thing's this big mystery, but there's elements of mystery that you know, that kind of pop up and threads that go through the story as it goes along, that I thought was really well done.
Yeah.
Did you think it was scary?
Yeah. I watched it in college in the theater, I think. Mm-hmm. I think universally it was shit on.
Yeah.
You know, I really enjoyed it though, mm-hmm. because I thought, well, the storytelling is kind of fun. It's compelling. And mm-hmm. yeah, the big revelation is that it's modern times. You know, but also, what does grief do to people? Mm-hmm. And why did they go to all these lengths? Like, how much was everyone hurting?
Yeah.
To be like, yeah, let's do this.
Yeah.
And how many societies actually do live out of, you know, secluded, away mm-hmm. from other people? Because yeah. they're like, you know, that it's a wicked place. Every, you know, cities and with all this stuff going on. And they kind of, like, have their own communities. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't seem that far-fetched, really, right. yeah. to be fair.
I mean, that's what my brother and sister-in-law are doing with their six kids out in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, just trying to be super agrarian and, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I found it really interesting. It's like they went to the lengths of saying there's creatures in the woods. Mm-hmm. You know, you shouldn't go. There's creatures. And to, you know, keep that little yarn going and
you mean that lie?
That lie.
Raise an entire generation of children afraid, lied to.
People scared of the woods.
Yeah.
But really, it's like I kind of thought, you know, what's scarier, actual real violence and murder and mm-hmm. things that are real possibilities where mm-hmm. they came from, or whatever might lurk in the woods that's, you know, probably not real.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Or just being lied to about the world.
Yeah. So, and then what lengths do you go to protect people?
Exactly. Or your like, loved ones is it too? It's for your own good. It's for your own benefit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but I found the movie really great. I love the scene where he's, you know, running to get Ivy and they go together into mm-hmm. the house running in the slow motion. I love when I can't remember his character's name, but Michael Pitt is looking down, peering down. He's terrified.
Yeah.
And he's just like, you can tell. It looks like he's just like his stomach turns, like flips over and he's yeah. like, oh my God.
Yeah. Cause he freezes for a minute before he rings the bell.
Yeah. And he's just like kind of huddles there, like, up and he's like, oh my gosh. And, yeah. And that's so scary for him and, mm-hmm. and for you as a viewer. So would I say overall, this is a terrifying movie? No, but there's mm-hmm. definitely elements of like suspense.
Yeah.
So a little scary, but really,
just good story.
Good story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I thought it was great.
Yeah. And so like, you know, the characterization. So I'm curious what your and Victor's conversation about Adrian Brody's characterization of Noah's character.
Well, I think I asked him a few days ago, we were driving and I was like, I just watched a rewatch of The Village and I've seen it a few times and I kind of spaced, I guess, or forgot that Noah was playing, a person who is mentally disabled. And I was like, how appropriate is that? Mm-hmm. And have we reached a point where you would want an actor's, you know, with these disabilities actually portraying that, right. you know, being more truthful in a character, basically. And I think even in recent years, there was another movie, I think I mentioned this when we were talking about it, when Victor and I were talking about it, it was a movie where Emma Stone, I think, played
An Asian character?
An Asian character. Yeah. A Hawaiian character. And mm-hmm. you're like, you're not. And there's so many actors.
To be fair, like,
are.
She's supposed to be mixed, and she looks exactly like our friend Rachel, who is also a quarter Korean.
Sure. But also, I see their point, where they're yes. like, there's so yeah. many actors who are Pacific Islanders. Why mm-hmm. would you even... Yeah. Why? Because you thought that name would attract more people?
Yeah, well, that's yeah. exactly why.
Exactly why. Yeah. And what at one point... Are you like, you know, we need to cast actors who can, you know, play these roles. Like there's, I think the movie, All the Light You Cannot See. I haven't actually watched it yet, but mm-hmm. I think the main the character is blind as mm-hmm. well. And I think the actor that plays her is blind yeah. in real life. So I think we're making strides towards having people yeah. who are
John Krasinski fought really hard to have an actual mm-hmm. deaf actress cast as his daughter in Quiet Place.
Yeah.
And then I know in that film Coda, the dad that got the the actor that got the Oscar, who I think played the dad in the movie, is actually deaf.
Yes. And that was like a historical movie because only this is the first time with that movie where mm-hmm. so many cast members were hearing mm-hmm. impaired.
Yeah.
And that had never really been a thing. So I think moving forward, I know that Leo DiCaprio's portrayal of Arnie and what he's doing, Gilbert Grape, is, you know what? Maybe yeah. not.
Maybe, yeah, well, it's hard because if it's somebody who legitimately acts like that and you know that they have that condition, then you view their behavior differently than maybe this is my generation or your generation too. I would hope that kids don't really do this anymore, but like that kind of behavior of like making fun and like, you know, we were the generation that called people retards. Like that was, you know, we had to actively work to take that word out of slang and out of, you know, what our kids understanding why that's not an acceptable, like, mean thing to call people. Yeah. But when you see yeah. someone like, you know, Adrian Brody, you know, this actor, you know, this man doesn't have that condition. And so when you see him acting that way to someone like me who grew up with that kind of behavior among children, that's how it kind of lands with me, is like, it looks to me like a little kid making fun of somebody.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to see past that and recognize that it might look exactly the same way if he actually did have a condition and was just behaving normally. So it's tricky. But I had the same thought about the character of Ivy, because Bryce Dallas Howard does an excellent job in that role. There's still elements where you're like, OK, but if you were actually blind, you couldn't do that. Like, right. you know, just her walking and running through the woods. Like, she has her hands out in front of her. She's groping. So like, okay, yeah, she's not going to run flat into a tree, but she would be tripping and stumbling. And like, you actually couldn't do that. You couldn't move that way, or you couldn't do that thing. Even if you were a highly capable visually impaired person, just because you just wouldn't be able to. And so you wonder how different that character would have looked if it had been played by an actually visually impaired person.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that in the end, our conversation ended with, I think we're just all striving. We as in the royal we and mm-hmm. people who are making movies are striving, you know, trying to do better mm-hmm. in their casting choices. This was released 20 years ago. Yeah. And even since then, there's been a lot of casting missteps with people getting pissed. Yeah. So you'd be like, why would you do that?
Well, and sometimes it's overcorrecting, because when the actress who was cast to play Mulan, she like wasn't ethnically Chinese. She was like, I don't know, Korean or something. Mm-hmm. And people were pissed that she wasn't Chinese because the character is Chinese. And I'm be glad. Are we glad it's not Emma Stone? Can we agree we're glad it's not Emma Stone?
I think it's good that it's not Emma Stone. We're not going to be like, I think we've come a long way from being like blackface, because right? gross.
Yeah.
And we've come
a long way.
Don't watch
Holiday Inn, people.
No. We've come a long way from people drawing lines on their faces and stuff and being like, look, I'm old, or look, my eyes are different, or whatever. And mm-hmm. you're like, no, come on. Like, we need to do better. So. I just think that I liked him in that role in this movie, but I don't know. It was something where I'm like, it didn't make me feel great.
Yeah, some of the scenes made you kind of uncomfortable. But like the scene where he attacks Lucius's character, like, is it? I thought that was like masterfully done. But that was because you were seeing a different emotion coming through him. Like his conflict, his sadness, his jealousy, feelings that he didn't have the ability to understand or cope with.
He made a deal with Ivy not to hit.
Yeah.
And so stabbing, I guess, is okay. Yeah. I don't know.
But then when you contrast it with like the scenes like you mentioned at the beginning where they're all at the table after a funeral and it's a very sober and somber moment. And then he's laughing and clapping. And so with that kind of element of his character, that's the one that starts to feel to me like, oh, is that bad? And so it's like, it depends on what level of portrayal. And like, I really think it is because the association I have with the whole children mocking like thing.
Yeah.
Was that something that you remember from when you were a kid?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And so did like this remind you of that at all?
I don't know. A little bit. I think on the rewatch now, after so many years, it just made me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think I was like, oh, I think I know why.
Yeah. So. It's because we're actually sensitive to that now.
Well, I mean, because we need to give a crap.
Yeah, we need to give a crap.
We need to give a crap. So, moving on.
Okay. So, our other flick for today, I did the recap for Knock at the Cabin, just came out in 2023. Neither Meredith nor I had seen it before we decided that we wanted to cover it. And we kind of made that determination. Based on, well, I didn't read anything of what it was about, but I saw it had Dave Bautista in it. It had Jonathan Groff in it. And so I was like, okay, yeah, let's do it. And
well, I like them.
Another wooded setting.
And Rupert Grint.
Rupert Grint. Yes.
Ron.
Ron Weasley was Ronald another
Weasley.
Excellent, excellent addition to the film. Anyhow, this is my somewhat truncated synopsis of Knock at the Cabin. And the first thing that I noted when, in the opening credits was that this was not an original M. Night Shyamalan screenplay, which most of his films are. This was adapted from a book.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't either until, and I'm glad that I happened to be, you know, paying attention right at the moment that that came on the opening credits. Because mm-hmm. I feel like it's relevant when you look at the story as a whole.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that I'll note when I get into what the story is actually about is, again, I didn't even read the one sentence synopsis on the screen on Netflix or on my phone on IMDb. I had no clue, no context what this was about at all. You know, just knowing that it was set, the setting was a cabin in the woods. Basically.
I think I saw like one trailer and I was like, eh.
Yeah.
I'll watch it later.
So it opens with a little girl whose name is Wen catching grasshoppers outside a secluded cabin in the woods when a man, Leonard, who is Dave Bautista's character.
Who's like a giant.
Yeah. We all know our good old Dave Bautista. Like you have the visual, all the visual you need right there. Leonard approaches and the two of them have a nice chat. But he says that he's there to do an important job as three other people walk out of the woods carrying bizarre weapons. Mm-hmm. Wen is obviously scared and runs inside the cabin, which we can now tell is a VRBO that she's staying at with her two dads, Andrew and Eric. And Eric is the dad played by Jonathan Groff, which, I mean, God, love that guy so much. Mm-hmm. So Leonard and his three pals knock at the door and ask to be let in. The dads realize that the phones have been cut and the four intruders soon successfully break in because it's, you know, just a cabin. There's windows everywhere and glass doors and blah, blah. So they break in. Eric tries to run for it and is knocked out. And then we cut to both dads are tied to chairs in the living room. And Wen is with them, too, but she's not tied up. The four visitors introduce themselves. Sabrina is a nurse. Leonard is a teacher. Redmond, who is Rupert Grint's character, works for the gas company, and I put is the real dick of the group. Mm-hmm. And then Adrian, a younger woman, is a line cook. And they explain that they are there to prevent the apocalypse, which is the thing that was in the one sentence summary on both IMDb and on Netflix or whatever. But I didn't read either of those. So up until this point, I didn't know what they were there for.
Like, is this a stranger situation?
Because that obviously would be the first association I would make is that I was sure it was more complex than that because their characters were being developed and as opposed to just being people in masks not talking. Mm-hmm. But I did not know that there was any element of it that was related to the apocalypse until they actually these four reveal that to the family. And what they tell the family is that they must willingly sacrifice one of themselves, or they will live, but the whole rest of humanity will die. And so the group, these four visitors, all know this information because of shared visions that they all had that brought them together via the internet. The dads, obviously,
via Reddit.
Well, it was this chat room, you see.
Chat room.
So the dads obviously don't believe, but they react to the situation in opposite ways. Andrew is very combative and argumentative and angry. And then Eric is very, like, kind of cajoling and reasonable. And, you know, they just have clearly very opposite temperaments in their relationship.
Yeah, I mean, who are the... There's Daddy Eric, played by Jonathan Groff.
Right.
And then who else?
Andrew. Daddy Andrew.
And he's a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
It's kind of in...
It goes with the flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, clearly, the dads refuse to commit the sacrifice. And the response from the visitors is that Redmond pulls a bag over his own head, kneels down, and states, "A part of humanity has been judged, and the three others in his group kill him with their crazy weapons." And then afterwards, Leonard turns on the TV and they all watch reports of a sudden earthquake that releases a giant tsunami on the Oregon coast. And this is meant to demonstrate the first plague that has been released by Redmond's death. Mm-hmm. And Redmond's death was the result of their refusal to kill one of themselves. And so they're told basically that one plague will be released with each of the visitors' deaths every time the family refuses to commit the sacrifice. And so there's, like, you know, there's four of them. There's going to be four plagues. And Leonard says that he will give them the night to think it over. Wen makes a run for it out of the house, but Leonard follows outside and catches her. Meanwhile, Andrew realizes that he had recognized Redmond, who is now dead, that Redmond was the man that had attacked Andrew in a bar years before in a homophobic assault.
Yeah.
He's like, it's him. And they're like, his name was this. And they're like, that's not his name. And Eric is kind of like disagreeing with Andrew, maybe. And so you think maybe because Andrew's like the really angry, the one responding with a lot of anger, you think like he's, you know, coming up with this, like this, you know, wouldn't be true. But he's using it to kind of further his belief that the visitors are delusional and that it can't be a coincidence that their family is the one that Redmond's group is attacking. If Redmond is the one that attacked him at this bar, this, you know, like 10 years ago or whatever. And so he's like, you know, making arguments about the way that they all met on the internet and where these ideas came from, and that maybe, you know, this was all something that Redmond put together himself, right, and manipulated them.
Yeah.
But
and Eric is like, I don't know, but also he's not a reliable person either because he's concussed.
Fully concussed, yeah. So he's in really bad shape.
He's like, I don't think so. And the other's like, it's him. It's definitely him. He's gained weight or not gained weight. I can't remember what he said, but he's like, but it's definitely him.
And he's like, go check his wallet. And they're like, we're not going to check his wallet. But he's just like, and part of it is that you don't really have a lot of confidence in Eric right now because of his concussion. And you don't have a lot of confidence in Andrew because if he's just like raging.
Yeah.
Right.
He's a little mad.
He's clearly not comfortable being out of control of a situation. Well, and being, having his life threatened.
Yeah. And be like, just kill yourself. Yeah. Don't worry about it. And you're like, I'd rather not.
Thanks, though. The next morning, Wen manages to steal a knife from the breakfast that she has served, and she gets it to Eric, who begins to work on cutting the rope that is tying his hands. Adrian appeals to Eric to believe their story. She talks to him about her son, Charlie. They're definitely like the remaining three visitors have recognized that Eric is like the one they have a better shot of convincing because he's not screaming and ranting and raving and furious. He's concussed and pliable.
Yeah.
And so Andrew keeps like, don't talk to him. Like, stop talking to him. Like, Eric, look at me, you know, because it seems like he's easily manipulatable in his condition.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say as the viewer. You're like, is he someone who can be manipulated more by these crazy people?
Yeah. But anyway, so, you know, Eric asks Adrian asks Eric, and he does refuse. So now it's Adrian's turn to put on the hood and be killed. She also states a part of humanity has been judged. And they go back to the TV. Now there is footage of a terrible virus that's claiming lives in many cities. But Andrew continues to argue that they're all delusional because he's been reading about this virus for weeks. How could it be a plague released by their current actions? And he's like, they read the reports about this and they already knew about the earthquake that happened there. And he's explaining away all of these catastrophic events that are happening, that they're not at all related to what's going on in this cabin. It's just either a coincidence or like a contrived situation that these delusional people have come up with.
Yeah, happenstance. Or is this being, was this recorded and being
exactly
like pumped back into the cabin for them to watch and be like, oh, see, look, this is our proof.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, this is bullshit.
Yeah. So then, Eric, he's kind of set this up. Like he earlier, like made a little comment to Wen when he was like, remember what you did at Thanksgiving? Like when I nod, blah, blah, blah. And so he cues her and she starts throwing this crazy tantrum. She just starts screaming and like tantruming cause she's, you know, like six or something.
And she's adorable
and she's absolutely adorable. And so then, you know, Leonard is trying to calm her down cause he's a second grade teacher. Like his character is very sweet and clearly like very like loves children. And he's like trying to calm her down and everything. And so in all of that chaos, both dads get their hands free. Like Eric gets his ropes cut and Andrew like has been working and has just worked his hands out of his ropes. Andrew gets outside to their truck, but Sabrina does follow him. He gets to the handgun that they had in like a little safe in the back of the truck before she can stop him. And he shoots, like he doesn't hit her, but he fires and she runs off into the woods. Andrew notices that the tires on their truck have been flattened and he goes back inside the house. While he's holding the gun on Leonard, suddenly Sabrina runs back into the house through the back door and Andrew shoots her because she's like running straight at him, you know. And so he shoots her. And then so even though Sabrina's already dead, Leonard puts the bag on her head and declares a part of humanity has been judged and chops her up. So she is like, you know, the third sacrifice, even though Andrew shot her rather than her being killed by her own group. So still in charge with the gun, Andrew goes outside to Redmond's body, gets the wallet and proves that he is the one who attacked Andrew in that bar those years before. Then Andrew locks Leonard in the bathroom, but they hear the window glass break. So they open the door. And this I thought was so funny because the window is like a little round, like porthole window. That's like maybe 18 inches across. And I'm like, do you think Dave Bautista got out of that?
There's no freaking way. He can't even put his thigh through there.
Yeah, but they didn't. I mean, obviously, they knew that he couldn't get out there. And the shower curtain is drawn. So Andrew fires the gun through the closed shower curtain. But Leonard still leaps out because you can shoot Dave Bautista all you want. And he's still Dave Bautista. So he leaps out of the bathtub and struggles with Andrew. And then Leonard ends up with the gun. Mm-hmm. So he turns on the TV and shows the plague supposedly triggered by Sabrina's death, which is planes inexplicably falling out of the sky. No explanation, just complete failure, plunging directly down to Earth all around the world. And the TV report says it's been about 700 planes at that point. Oh, just spontaneously, gosh. All of these planes crashing with no explanation.
Yeah, just like, oh, just dropping.
Yeah. Then Leonard begins speaking along with the newscaster in real time, word for word, like saying what she's saying with her while she's saying it. And so because he, you know, this report is something that he had seen in his visions. And so like, you know, as it continues, like everything gets more and more convincing as each one is revealed. So now Leonard moves to the back deck and takes a seat. He says that, you know, once I'm dead, you'll only have a few moments. The dads still refuse to commit the sacrifice. And so with their final refusal, Leonard says all of humanity has been judged and cuts his own throat. So the sky immediately darkens and it looks like in the distance, like balls of fire start falling from the sky. And so the dads send Wen to go hide in a treehouse and they go inside the house. Actually, I think they send Wen to the treehouse before Leonard cuts his throat.
Yeah, I think
I hope so. Yeah. But anyway, so Wen is told to go off and wait in the treehouse until one of her dads comes and gets her. And the two, Andrew and Eric, go back inside. They understand now, and what they kind of, the exposition that happens now in their dialogue is that the visitors were the, you know, symbolic of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and they represented humanity's qualities of guidance, which was Leonard as a teacher, healing, which was Sabrina as a nurse, nurturing, which was Adrian as, you know, feeding people and cooking, and then malice, which was Redmond for being a dick. And Eric argues that they have to commit the sacrifice, but now they both want to be the one to do it. Like, no, you kill me. No, you kill me. Silly. and so all we hear is the gunshot. And then Andrew is the one to climb into the treehouse where Wen asks him, did Daddy Eric save everyone? And it's like, it's so sad because she hasn't been shielded from any of this dialogue or conversation at any point. Like, she's been listening and she's old enough to understand what they've been saying. And so when she asks that, it's not like, where's Daddy Eric or, you know, what happened or anything. Like, she has been paying attention. She knows the fact that Daddy Andrew is here, what that means.
She seems very intuitive and she's a really bright kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So now the house is burning, but it's also raining, like all of the little balls of fire and the fires that have started in the woods because of them, like the rain is putting the fires out. As Andrew and Wen leave the cabin on foot, they find Redmond's truck and drive until they get to a truck stop. TVs there show reports of all of the tragedies or plagues ending. That, you know, like, oh, we haven't had a death in this hospital in like 2 hours. It's the first time we've gone, you know, more than 15 minutes without a death in days and everything. And then, you know, oh, all the planes of the rest of the planes that are in the air have all landed safely and airports have grounded all the flights. Like, basically, like, it corrected, like, Eric's death corrected everything. And then the final scene, it was really sweet. So at an earlier part in the movie, and because there were, you know, a couple flashbacks to earlier points in Andrew and Eric's relationship as like character building and everything that I didn't mention. But there was one flashback, which was the three of them driving up to the cabin in the first place. And they put on that song Boogie Shoes. That's like clearly like their little family's favorite song. And they're all singing along to the radio. And Wen knows all the words. And it's really like this sweet moment of the three of them before any of this happened. And then they get back into Redmond's truck after finding that, you know, the plagues have been ended and the apocalypse has been averted. And when he turns the car on, Boogie Shoes is playing. And like Andrew, what's like Andrew turns it off. And then Wen leans over and she turns it back on. And then they leave it on for a moment. And then Wen leans over and she turns it off again. And that's the end. That is the end of Knock at the Cabin. And I could tell by the look on Meredith's face before I even started that she did not like this movie. So, Meredith, what'd you think of Knock at the Cabin?
No. Really? It was a horrible. It wasn't like the worst movie I've ever seen. It's not Leprechaun.
I mean, come on. It's not the worst thing Katie's made me watch.
It's probably better than Tarot.
Yes.
Definitely Tarot. Yeah. Not that I've seen Tarot, but mm-hmm. I thought it was okay. Mm-hmm. I was like expecting more. But you know, it was fun, interesting hour, 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay. And it ended. I was like, well, all right.
That happened.
And I didn't really think much about it more. It didn't feel compelling to me. It didn't feel, I don't know. There's not really a part where I was like, maybe they are crazy.
Oh, you didn't get invested.
Well, I mean, not to say I didn't get invested. I'm just saying I think you're a lot of it's like trying to get you really thrown off.
Okay.
And I didn't feel thrown off at all.
Okay.
And you probably felt the same way where you're like, yeah, this is probably not a thing or this is probably real.
Yeah, that's right. I see what you're saying because there wasn't really a point where I thought these people are delusional.
Yeah.
I assumed that this was real, that that what would be revealed is that they were telling the truth and that someone and you could kind of tell like, OK, the end of this movie is going to be them like someone dying. Like you could have not that I try to do that this when I watch movies, because I usually try not to guess what's happening or guess what's coming or what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But even me, if I had tried to, I would have been like, yeah, okay, all four of them are going to die. That's going to convince the family. One of the dads is going to die, and they're going to stop the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're right that there wasn't any yep. like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, are they crazy? Is it real? Like, what? And then, you know, to make that connection between Andrew's character and Redmond's character, but then not have it mean anything or like, even if it ultimately ended up not meaning anything, it could have been, they could have made it. I don't know, like, if it was intended to make the viewer think maybe the whole thing was made up.
Yeah, I think it, I don't know, at least from my perspective, I think that that connection was intended to be a setup of some kind to make you throw you off.
Yeah.
And I wasn't buying it.
Yeah. All it made me think was like, oh, well, this is just going to fuel Andrew's okay. disbelief.
Yeah. So I was just like, okay. I mean, I liked the characters, and I really liked.
I like Dave Bautista's character yeah. a lot.
Because he's like, so like kind. And he's like, he's like, I really don't want to do this.
Yeah.
And at first you're like, sure, buddy. And then you kind of see what he has to do and you're like, no, oh, okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want to do this.
Yeah.
And he's pretty horrified about the whole thing. And he talks about this little basketball team or yeah. whatever. And he's like, they're not really good, but we have a lot of heart.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh.
Like, you want really, him to be your kid's yeah. teacher and you're coach. Like, oh,
that's really sweet. And I did like the moment where they were like, basically Eric was like, I see a vision of you and Wen as she's an adult and you are deciding where to go to dinner. And she's an adult, but she's also her same self.
Yeah.
And I want you to have that.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, that's really lovely. And there are moments that I...
That was just the concussion talking, though.
It's just a concussion. He's like, I'm freaking tripping balls. He's like,
I'm also seeing dancing purple penguins in the corner of the room right now.
But, I mean, there were the flashbacks and the character building. So I did care about the characters. So it could have been way, way worse. I could be like, I don't care about this.
Yeah, like Tara.
And sometimes I do feel that way when I watch a movie. So mm-hmm. them adopting Wen and being like, you know, having their family together for the first time as a family unit and mm-hmm. other things. And you're like, these characters clearly love each other very, very much. Yeah. So, you know, but it just fell short, excuse me, to yeah. me in the end.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think I thought it was pretty entertaining. I mean, our question, do you think it's like, obviously no moment of this movie was scary whatsoever.
No, except even with people getting beheaded.
Yeah, I would say the one part that kind of got me a tiny bit was when they turned on the TV and it showed all the planes crashing.
Yeah.
That, because yeah. that like kind of, it was, it. I don't know, like that wasn't what I was expecting really to be the next, you know, plague, even though they did a whole little speech at the beginning of what all the plagues would be and that like, you know, the sea will come up and swallow, blah, blah, blah. And then there's a tsunami and then, you know, the sky will like there was the, and it's, you know, kind of like with Omen or how are we going to interpret the rise of the Roman Empire? Oh, the Treaty of Rome. But I didn't anticipate that the next thing that would happen would be planes falling out of the sky.
Like the sky rejected them.
Right.
Like, not today, humans.
There's like in the news footage of that plague, there's like some people standing. It's like phone footage of people standing on a balcony just watching and like just planes right and left dropping out of the sky and like, you know, plumes of black smoke billowing up from spots where previous planes had crashed. And I felt mm-hmm. like that kind of got me for a moment when that first happened.
I think so. And also, I mean, we're a generation where we watched 9/11 happen in real
yeah.
time.
Yeah. Maybe that's
so
it.
So maybe we're like, oh,
maybe I shouldn't be too surprised.
Right.
By that.
But we saw that happen
yeah.
in real life.
Mm-hmm.
And our younger viewers who didn't see that, you know, who maybe learned about it later.
Mm-hmm.
But us, we were watching it. I was awake that morning watching mm-hmm. and I just watched a plane fly into a building
yeah.
and smoke was billowing from the building. And you're mm-hmm. like, oh, what?
That's exactly what it looked really, like.
Is that really what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do understand that kind of like, oh, your stomach drop a little bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you see something like yeah. that, even in a movie.
Yeah. But as far as the like, because obviously there was a lot of violence involved in the visitors all killing each other. But even though it wasn't like violence out of anger, obviously they were doing it because they out of necessity, like they had to. But they didn't show any of it. And I feel like that's fairly consistent for M. Night Shyamalan's for the most part. Mm-hmm. He cuts away from like blood and gore.
Yeah.
Because even like when Leonard kills himself at the end, you know, he does. I mean, he pretty graphically like put the knife in his neck and cut his own throat. But it zooms. It's like a slow closing in, like irising in on him sitting in the chair. So that by the time he actually does that motion, his neck is not in the frame anymore. His face isn't in the frame anymore. And you just see the blood running down his shirt.
Yeah, it's just on his chest.
Yeah. And so there, even though that's the closest they came, I think, to showing any of the violence, you still, it's not like front and center, like jumping in your face. And I think that that's very consistent, you know, for M. Night Shyamalan. There's some, when we talk about The Happening eventually, like that was, there was some violence in The Happening that was kind of defied that a little bit. But for the rest of his movies, I don't see a lot of, like, you know, aggression, violence actually shown on camera.
Definitely, he's not a Tom Savini kind of having brains fly out.
No gags for him.
No gags for him. But, you know, overall, I'm glad I watched it. It was on my list. I was going to watch it eventually, so yeah. I did it to you know, check it off, and then we could talk about it. But to say I would recommend it, not really.
Yeah.
If I'm recommending his movies, it would be other films.
Other ones, I think. And it's hard to gauge, like, what if, you know, the fact that he didn't write it. You know, that's going to have, especially for a filmmaker like him who writes almost everything he does himself.
Yeah.
You know, because I imagine most directors out there, it's like, it's a little of this and a little of that, if they're even involved in writing, which a lot of them aren't involved in the writing of any of the things they direct. But if you're someone who most of your career has been, this is your project. You wrote the screenplay, you directed the movie, you produced the movie. Like, they all belong to you on a level that, you know, maybe other films don't. And so to see him, you know, come and do something where it's like, this isn't my story. I didn't come up with this idea.
But how would you, like, no pun intended, execute this?
Yeah. And so it's like, yeah, that's why there's no twist endings, because he didn't write it.
Exactly.
And he's got to have his twist endings. Yeah. But yeah, so I wonder how much of the feel of this was like that. If it didn't really feel like an M. Night Shyamalan movie, I would say that would be why.
Yeah, it didn't feel authentically his. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, it was fine.
It was fine.
Netflix streaming. Yeah. So.
Not a total waste of time.
No. Not by any means. But we are going to be doing...
Ooh, big one next.
A triple.
Triple fur.
Yes. So it's an over... Well, all of the movies are related to each other.
Mm-hmm, it's a trilogy.
Yes. Yeah, so Unbreakable, released in 2000. Split... in 2016, in Glass, to wrap up the trilogy, released in 2019.
Yeah.
So that'll be our next episode. Mm-hmm. I watched Unbreakable when it came out. I enjoyed it. And then I only just recently, as in when I was sick with a cold or whatever it was I had, watched Split and Glass.
Yeah.
Not to say, like, Split just seemed to make, like, I didn't watch it because I felt like it would make me too anxious.
Oh, really?
I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. But, yeah, no, I also watched Unbreakable when it first came out. I haven't seen it since, so I gotta go check that out again. And then Split and Glass, I watched pretty close to when they came out. I love James McAvoy.
He's amazing.
Love him. And
I love him so much. And he was so great. He was so great.
Was it Anya Taylor-Joy or Hayley Stanfield that was in that?
Anya
Taylor-Joy, yeah. And, you know, love her too. So, you know, seeing that they were both in Split, I definitely was like on that one pretty post-haste. But I've got to rewatch all three.
Yeah,
and it'll be interesting to watch all three of them as a unit, because, like, you know, that's 16 years between the first and the second story in, you know, a trilogy is a really, really big gap. And so to actually go back and watch Unbreakable for the first time in almost 25 years, and then go immediately from that to these other chapters in the story, I think will be kind of fun.
Yes. And it has to be at least 10-15 years since I saw Unbreakable.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to rewatch. But anyway, if you want to be current.
Yeah, check those out.
watch those before you listen, because we're going to spoil them.
As we do.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening.
All right. Bye.